Hello, and thank you for listening to the podcast of the Vineyard Church Maryville here in Maryville, Tennessee. If you haven't already, you can visit our website to find out more information about our church or to find our full audio archive with all of our messages. So you can find all of that at www.vineyardchurch.us, or you can also subscribe on Apple and Google Podcasts. Now, let's hear this week's message.
Welcome to the Vineyard. Hi. That's awesome. Good to see you guys. My name, as he said, my name is Aaron. Really glad to be here with you. I don't mind AJ doing the announcements at all. That's not a problem for me, even in the slightest. That was just pure fun. Hey, we're going to jump into the sermon in just a minute. I just want to say one thing first. It seems like I always have a little bit of a preamble these days. But I want to take just a minute, and if you guys can, maybe now's a good time to check your phones or whatever's bothering you. I'm going to take just a minute to talk to the folks on the live stream, if that's okay. I am so grateful for our folks who join us online. I just want to say this. We love you guys. We miss you guys. COVID is bonkers. I totally understand. If you're like choosing to stay home, it makes a lot of sense. It's okay if you guys need to make that own decision. Everybody has to do their own math, and kind of we all have our own calculations we have to make about that. We don't have declarations to make. We just have opportunities to give. Such a preacher. Opportunities to attend church in person and online. And so to folks who join us online, we're so glad you're not forgotten. And you guys don't know this, but the folks online do. It seems like the last several weeks in particular, it's like we keep hitting these little glitches one way or another. Things just keep not working. And so at the moment, it's working. In fact, I'm looking at it right now. I'm watching myself watch myself right now. I think this is inception. My mind is blown. So it's working, but there have been glitches along the way. I just want to say to the folks who are online, thank you so much for hanging out with us. Thank you so much for being patient as we have variables. You know, a lot of people are getting COVID. That affects our tech teams as well. And also one thing I just want you guys to know, as we've had various problems, I just want you to know that it's been different problems. It's not the same problem every week and we're just like, we're not going to fix it. We fix it and then there's new problems. By we, I do not mean me at all. I mean people who can do stuff like that. We fix it and then new problems pop up. And so the time will come when we're totally committed to live stream. We're going to keep doing it. The time will come when we've got it like all nailed down. We're just not there yet. We'll get there. Hang with us. We love you. Awesome. Done with that. We are going to continue our series we started last week called Marriage Eternal. And we're going to dive right in here. This is part two. I've entitled this one, A Great American Love Story. A Great American Love Story from the Bible, which is incredible because it was written long before America was even a thing. And it's hard to find modern love stories at all in the Bible because the Bible is not a modern book. The Bible was written a very, very long time ago, and we have a very, 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 very different system today around dating and romance than we have had throughout the largest portion of human history. Now, I want to be very clear as I say this part. I'm not an historian or anything approaching a historian. Don't give me too much credibility just because I have a microphone attached to my face. I want to be clear. I'm not that. I'm just going on. I'm kind of trusting what I read other people say. But here's the thing. The best I can tell is we have a really, really different system than pretty much anybody anywhere before us did. And apparently, if we just go back a couple of hundred years, our current approach to dating and romance are like really unique, perhaps entirely unique. Like the way we go about it, I want to make sure you get this, the way we go about it today wasn't even a thing in this world until pretty much the modern industrial revolution, which historically is not that long ago. And then it took quite a time to develop into essentially what it is today. And so this is unique, and I'm not saying that the current system is better or worse than the old system. What I'm actually saying is that the current system is both better and worse than the old system. I think the way that we do like marriage and romance and courtship or whatever the language is, I think the way we do it today is just really jacked up in a bunch of ways. And I think the way that it's largely been done throughout history is also really jacked up, like in a bunch of ways. So like throughout history, I mean, I'm just sort of painting with broad strokes here, but historically speaking, we're talking about arranged marriages. Weird. Bride prices. Weirder still. And this really unfortunate scenario where sometimes, in extreme cases, the thoughts and feelings and input of those people who were actually getting married was not regarded at all. It was entirely the work of the parents and all set up and arranged. Weird. So I acknowledge that doesn't feel great. It feels like something important is missing. But I also want to acknowledge that, like, the pendulum has swung so far, as history typically does. The pendulum has swung way over, and now we have the other extreme. And if you guys will just, I know it's sort of early in a sermon for me to have a rant, but can I rant for just a minute? What we do now, guys, I want you to stay with me for this part, is really messed up. It's really weird arrangement. Here's what we do. Here's what we do. We take children, okay? Children. All right, adolescents are children. And even through young adulthood, through most of our 20s, our bodies and brains are still developing. So no judgment. I'm just going to call them all children. We take children throughout most people in their dating years, okay, primarily. I know there are many, many exceptions to that. But we take children and we push them out into the great unknown and we say, now, go find the one. Go find the one. That's the instructions. And guess what? The one is not a thing. That's a mythical creature. There's no such thing as the one. We should send our children out looking for flying unicorns that fart clouds of glitter and just say, children, go look for the glitter clouds. And they'll say, I don't know. What is the one? What does it look like? Well, it's different for everyone. Okay, thanks. Well, how will I know? You'll just know. And we're saying this to children who are experiencing the world in a new way, and all these different things are going on in their bodies biologically. They're flooded with chemicals and hormones and emotions and lust and sexual frustration. All of this is happening at once, which any one of those things individually will impair your judgment. And then we go, all right, now's the time for you to go out into the world looking for the one that doesn't exist. And you need to, in short order now, because we want grandkids, in short order, you need to pick the absolute perfect one, and you better get it right the first time, or maybe your whole life will be ruined. Okay, mom. Okay, dad. Oh, and here's the other thing. Also, just, I've mentioned this before, let me remind you. We have this thing in our brains called the prefrontal cortex. Your prefrontal cortex, here's what it does. Let's think about this. The prefrontal cortex is a part of your brain that does complex sort of calculations of measuring cause and effect as it extends out into the future. The part of your brain that goes, okay, if I make this decision or that decision, it will affect me in this way down the line. In other words, all the calculations you have to make while you're looking for a spouse, that part of your brain isn't even fully formed until your mid to late 20s. Come on! And that's when most people are out making the decisions that are most necessary for the part of their brain that doesn't work. All while they're flooded with hormones and emotions and changes are going on in their body. Are you kidding me? This is what we do to our children. It's messed up. I was thinking about it this week and I decided that it is like taking your child into a forest or something, I don't know, and then pointing to a target that they can't even see. And this child is impaired, okay, because of the things that I've already mentioned. So basically, they're drunk, okay? Their judgment is impaired as if they were drunk. So we put drunk children in the woods, and we say, there, off in the distance, I know you can't see it, is a target. It doesn't really exist, but hit the target, get it right the first time. Okay, how do I hit the target? Here's some bubbles. You get one shot. I think that's what we do. I think that's how we do it. It is so messed up. So, historically, we either have arranged marriages, where we like consult the children none, or way over on the other side of the spectrum, the children are entirely alone. Help me, mom and dad. No, you'll just know. You'll know it when you see it. Well, I have some questions. Well, I don't want to answer your questions because I'm afraid you're going to ask me about sex. And even though I'm an adult, I can't have that conversation. Or even worse, I'm afraid you'll ask how your mother and I or your father and I did it. And I really, really don't want to have that conversation. So I'm not going to answer any questions. If you have, just consult the internet or TikTok and fill in the blanks that way. That's on the other end of the spectrum. And so you're saying, what are you saying, Aaron? Do we need to have arranged marriages? No, I'm not saying that. Here's the truth. I don't have any clue what we should do. I don't. But here's what I do feel like. Feels like maybe somewhere in between. That's my two cents. Somewhere in between. Sermon's not about that. Off the rant box. But so anyway, I said all that to say it's different now than in the Bible, okay? It's sort of a different deal. But I did find one great modern love story in the Bible, and heads up, I do not mean that as a compliment. The story we're going to look at is in Genesis, written a very long time ago. The whole thing is just a total train wreck. It is just like grief and loss and twisted metal. It's a nightmare. Do you want to look at it together? Let's read it together. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 29. Heads up before we get there. A lot of moving parts to this story. I'm going to be summarizing quite a bit, but I'm not trying to keep anything from you. In fact, I want to encourage you to read the whole story, which really goes from chapter 27 to about chapter 35, something like that. And you might hear that and say, well, that sounds like a lot of reading to do. Trust me, it's history's first soap opera. It is a page turner, okay? You will not get bored. Encourage you to read it. But the part that we're going to look at really centers around this guy named Jacob, okay? And Jacob, we could say some nice things about Jacob. I guess he has some redeeming qualities, but if we're going to paint with broad strokes, the fact is Jacob was a jerk, okay? He was just a jerk. His name, Jacob, means deceiver, and he was a deceiver. He could lie and cheat and steal with the absolute best of them. Interesting note about Jacob, his grandfather was Abraham, like Father Abraham with many sons Abraham. So that's Papaw. That's kind of a big deal historically, and that's Jacob. And here's this really messed up thing. One day, Jacob, the deceiver, he stole his older brother's birthright. And if you don't know what that means, that's okay. Just suffice to say, it's a really, really, really big deal. And it's a really messed up thing to steal that from your older brother. He steals that from his older brother by tricking his father, Isaac, from his deathbed. The whole thing is messed up. After that happens, he goes to live with a guy named Laban. Laban was his uncle. And there he met Rachel. Rachel was just super hot, okay? The Bible is actually pretty direct about the way the Bible is direct about such things. The Bible is pretty direct about that. She's really hot. And Jacob, unsurprisingly, is totally and instantly infatuated with this woman. The day that Jacob met this woman, he kissed her on the mouth and wept for joy. And it was his cousin. And I haven't even gotten to the weird part yet. So there's your setup. Genesis chapter 29, verse 16. Now Laban, that's the uncle, he had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger, this is the one he was hot for. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. That's as far as the Bible's ever going to go to say, okay, total package, absolute smoke show. That's what it says. But it says this thing about Leah. It says Leah had weak eyes, which is a really strange thing. It's kind of hard to translate. Here's what's going on. It's a Hebrew euphemism. Okay, so it's kind of a not nice, but maybe not as mean way to say that Leah was just not attractive at all. Okay, she was an unattractive person in a way that the Bible felt inclined to make note of it. Whatever that means. All right, verse 18. Jacob was, of course, in love with Rachel and said, this is what he says to his uncle Laban, I will work for you for 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Remember he said bride prices and arranged marriages. He couldn't afford a bride price because he was kind of on the run because he was shady. And so he said, I'll work for 7 years in order to make this happen. Why? Because Jacob was in love. So let's stop here for a minute. I want to talk about this. Jacob was in love with Rachel. Now, there are lots of stories in the Bible about love. Lots of romances and couples, good ones, bad ones, ones who are deeply committed to one another, ones not so much. Lots of romance, lots of love. The Bible loves love. Okay, but there are only two people in the whole Bible that it says were in love. We have Jacob here who is in love with Rachel. And I've already told you, I kind of sort of spoiled it, but I've already told you that this is an absolute disaster. Just, it's a total train wreck from here, okay? And the other one, church kids, for those of you Sunday school rats in the room, the other one was Samson. Samson, who had a way with the ladies, but then absolutely blew it, fell on his face in the worst ways. And for him, it happened twice. Samson, first with a woman named Timnath, who he defied his parents' orders in order to marry this woman. And then she later betrayed him in a way that actually would have led to his death had he not been something like an ancient superhero. So that's the only reason he survived Timnath. And he also, the Bible says, fell in love with Delilah, not B97.5 Delilah, Bible Delilah, which, here's the thing, the first girl he was in love with nearly did him in. The second girl he was in love with somehow went worse, and she also betrayed him and did so to his ruin and ultimately to his death. Jacob and Samson, the only two people the Bible says directly fell in love, and in each case, a total disaster. Maybe there's a hint in here for us that in each case there was a defiance of tradition. The advice of parents was completely ignored. In each case, a young man, code for drunk child, a young man with raging hormones and a non-functioning prefrontal cortex saw a beautiful woman and declared their undying love. What happened? Guys, they were infatuated. They had this surging flood of emotions and lust and intrigue, and they acted like people do when they were infatuated. Like maybe you have done when you have been infatuated. Here's what they did. They just kept shoving wisdom inside, pushing it aside, all in service to the fantasy of the one. The one who would make them whole or complete or ultimately satisfied or whatever kind of nonsense they currently believed. And that is why I think we are looking at a great modern love story here in the ancient book of Genesis, because that's pretty much how we do it now. We get infatuated. Something that, and we know this, but somehow we don't know this, something that always fades. And then we make lifelong decisions based on that, because that's what we call love. Feeling alive and happy and fulfilled and a fluttering heart. We go, oh, that's love. No, it's not. It's infatuation. And you might hear that and go, Aaron, you are being horribly unromantic right now. Have you ever even been in love? Well, guys, according to this definition, the pervasive cultural definition of being in love, oh yeah, many times. Many, many. Sharon included, she's on the list. But many, many times. First it was Mariah Carey. It didn't last long. Sort of burned hot and failed out. You know, Sheryl Crow for a while. I'm not sure why, but that one lasted for a while. Something about her. There's a whole stack of girls from high school. I'm not really sure, but based strictly on that definition, I think I once fell in love with a bowl of ice cream. Feeling alive and happy and fulfilled and Twitter-pated. Come on, guys. Look, I know it sounds cold and unromantic. I know. Guys, I could basically, in most people, generate the same thing with like a really good slice of cheesecake or a really well-timed compliment at just the right moment. All the things. A glass of wine will do it for a lot of folks. I'm told heroin can really shift the mood. It's not a suggestion. I recommend against it strongly, but that's what I'm told. Love, as thought of, conceived of, defined by most people in our society, is based purely on emotion, and frankly, it's a fart in the wind. And again, I know that sounds cold and unromantic, but the truth is, here's the actual truth. The truth is, I'm just way too romantic to settle for that definition. All right, I'm gonna hop back on that soapbox, but let's go back to the text, verse 19. So if you remember, he said, I'll work for you for 7 years, Jacob did, if I can have Rachel. And so here's what Laban said. It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. That's a weird sentence. Stay here with me. Verse 20. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel. Listen, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. You might hear that and go, oh, he is so romantic. Just keep reading the very next verse. Then after those 7 years, Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife. My time is completed and I want to make love to her. Could you? Oh, okay. Gotcha. That's what the hopeless romantic wanted. He wanted to get laid by the hot girl. That's what was actually going on. And listen, can you imagine? Can you imagine saying that to your father-in-law? Go get me my wife. I'm ready for her. Can you? And if that's the way he spoke to his father-in-law, how must he have spoken to her, or God forbid, his friends? So, okay. But if you read that and go, no, I'm still sort of caught up in this. I still think Jacob is just this misunderstood Don Juan type. It's really beautiful and romantic that he was willing to work for 7 years just to get his one true and undying love. Then once again, look no further than the next couple of verses, verse 22. So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. That's the wedding ceremony. He gets Rachel finally, verse 23. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah. Leah, not that's not Rachel. Took her daughter, his daughter Leah, and brought her to Jacob, and Jacob made love to her. It is hard to say that Jacob was just so enthralled by the soul and personality of Rachel that when another woman was brought to his tent, he didn't even notice the difference. And it was probably dark, and he was probably drunk, and still, right? Surely. Verse 25, when morning came, there was Leah. There's old weak eyes. Now what? There was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? There's another reason, by the way, that this sounds like a great modern love story is because it involves someone getting drunk and waking up with enormous regrets. That sounds pretty modern to me. And then for Jacob, of all people, why have you deceived me? Verse 26, Laban replied, it's not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one, and I neglected to tell you that until after you had worked for 7 years. Verse 27, finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. I think it's pretty odd. And there's a justice part of me that it's not good, but enjoys the fact that Jacob, the deceiver, is the one who gets duped and terribly so. It's hard to con a con man. But here's the thing. It's just further evidence, guys, of his infatuation. Because, as we all know, infatuation makes idiots of us all. And Jacob was no different. So, the story keeps going, and there's more twisted metal. We'll maybe get there next week. But I just want to pause here and point out there are just three times that the scripture says that someone was in love. And now there's lots of love in the Bible, but three times that someone was in love, and all three cases, that person had absolutely no idea what that meant, and they definitely weren't. And I think the Bible's trying to show us something. So let me read you a quote. This is by John Mark Comer. He's an author I really appreciate. He said this, when we say we love someone, we mean we have deep feelings of affection because they make us feel alive all over again, adventurous, brave, happy. Love, come on, by this definition, is pure, unfiltered emotion. And your role, don't miss this, your role in love then is passive. It's something that happens to you. Think of the phrase, fall in love. It's like tripping over a rock or a curb, and it's fantastic. But there's a dark underbelly to feeling this kind of romantic love. If we can fall into it, then we can fall out of it. And here's what I'm really driving at. For some reason, stay with me now. For some reason, we tend to put romantic love in a totally different category, all to itself, away, apart, and separate from all the other kinds of love. And anything romantic is kind of way over in one category, and all the other kind of loves are over in this other category, as if they aren't the same thing expressed in different ways and in different contexts. Love is love. The foundation is the same. Of course, there are different kinds of love. It all sits on the same foundation. And the tragedy of this is that we have largely, stay with me, and I want you to notice this. We have largely defined non-romantic love. I think I put that one over here. When I don't remember, but let's pretend. Non-romantic love over here, and we've largely defined it with words like commitment and friendship and trust and loyalty and service and sacrifice. And then over here, we define romantic love largely with words like desire and emotion and attraction and mystery and fluttering hearts. And it's like the bachelorization of the whole process. I do or I do not feel a spark. I do or I do not feel a connection. The flame either has or has not flickered out. We base the romantic love, stay with me, the love that leads to marriage, the love that we make vows around, the love that is the two becoming one and lifelong commitment, that conversation centers around all of the stuff that literally comes and goes with our moods. The way that we have defined and separated the different kinds of love, I think it's beyond question. We have clearly made romantic love the weakest. We've made it the weakest, the most vulnerable. And then we build our lives and our families and even our societies on these weak, wrong-headed ideas. And it's no wonder then that marriages are fragile and families are fragile. And this phenomenon that I'm talking about, this is just based on my perspective, but it seems clear to me at least. It's just becoming more and more entrenched. I really think that it is. As marriage increasingly is upheld more and more and understood more and more as a means to being perpetually swept off of your feet. And it has materialized in what is quickly becoming my least favorite sentence in the whole English language. I hate this sentence. Here it is. I still love you. I'm just not in love with you anymore. I hate that sentence with a passion. I'm tired of seeing my friends and people I love deeply have their lives ripped apart because of that blubbering nonsense of a sentence. I love you. I'm just not in love with you anymore. If you're going to say that, you might as well say, hey, I fell for the whole cultural phenomenon, hook, line, and sinker. I'm totally duped, and now I have absolutely no idea what love is. That's what you should say instead of, I love you, I'm just not in love with you anymore. I let society define it for me, and somehow it's gotten so turned around and inside out, somehow I've turned love, which is the most pure and selfless and sacrificial of all forces in the universe, I've turned it into something deeply and profoundly selfish. You might as well say, I've made this whole thing into a means by which I demand to feel flush with emotion and on the edge of a swoon for all my days. And if you can't keep my heart fluttering for the rest of my life, that's apparently your problem because I'm entitled to that now. Because what I really meant when I said for better or for worse was as long as I'm Twitter-pated. What I really meant when I said as long as we both shall live, what I really meant was as long as I am flush with emotion. Oh, gosh. How did that happen? I know I'm coming down pretty heavy-handed. I've got some hurts connected to that sentence. And I don't mean to be mean-spirited, but I also think we've just got to expose the lie. I think it's really important. And let me point out something I think really obvious, which is this. We don't do this with any other kind of love. We don't do it with any other kind of love. Can you imagine, can you even imagine sitting your mom down and say, Mom, I still love you. I'm just not. I just don't feel the spark anymore like we once did. I don't feel the same connection, Mom, that we once did, you know, when you fed and clothed me. It's a little different now. I feel differently now. I just don't respond to you the same way that we once did, so now I'm done. Can you? Or sitting down with one of your dearest friends. I still love you, friend. I just don't feel in friendship with you anymore the way that I used to feel. It just doesn't feel that way anymore. Or can you even, this is so bonkers. Can you imagine sitting down your child? I still love you, of course I do. I always will. We've been through a lot. I'll always love you. And I still love you. I'm just not in love with you anymore. You know, when you were just a little baby, you were so adorable. And you were cooing and crawling around and giggling. And every time I saw you do basically anything, it just made my heart leap inside of me. But now, we're in a different phase now. You know, like now you have pimples and you talk back and you're kind of a smart aleck about it. And I just don't feel the way I used to, so I'm opting out. You don't do it for me the way you once did anymore. That's bonkers. That's call the police crazy, isn't it? It is. And yet it's entirely what we do with the relationships that we have founded our lives and society is on. Guys, how did we fall for the lie that makes romantic love by far the weakest of them all? And so here's my point. All the kinds of love are built on the same foundation. Do you understand? The same core values, the same commitments. And now let me once again acknowledge how cold and unromantic I am sounding. Okay, I know it. Let me address that quickly, and then I'm probably going to jump right back on the same soapbox. But let me address it. I love my wife. I didn't know it was possible to love somebody that much, and every day I swear it's more. And in 9 days, it's going to be 19 years. It's a pretty good run. And every day I swear I love her more. I don't even know how it's possible. I love my wife profoundly. And so I love my wife in like the good definitions, and I'm also in love with her. Like based on the really crappy, societally informed definitions, that too. I am in love with her. She makes my heart race. I'm not sure what Twitterpated means, but I think I am. I am routinely swept off of my feet by that woman, and it might sound arrogant to say so, but I'm pretty sure she is too. Guys, our pet name for each other is Pookie, okay? I'm a grown man. Unironically, I call my wife Pookie. Sometimes I forget and do it when people are around. She says it to me, or Pooks for short. Sometimes she calls me Pooks because we've been saying that for 19 plus years now, Pooks. Now, that's becoming a bit of a problem because we have a dog now and her nickname for the dog is Pups, and sometimes she gets them mixed up and calls me Poops. And that is not a compliment. And I said to her, Don't have a lot of rules. Don't call me Poops. All right? Guys, I am head over heels for this woman. Here's what I'm saying. You really can't have both. And next week I'm going to talk about how to do that. All right? You're like, okay, fine. If it's not going to be this much of a bummer next week, I'll come. Okay, it's not going to be. I'm going to talk about that next week. How do you maintain that? But listen, first and foremost, hear me on this. We've got to get our definition straight. We got to know what we're talking about. And to get those definitions, we're going to go to the Bible really quickly. 1 John chapter 4, verse 10. This is love. You know, I wish the Bible would just give us a definition and just tell us what is love. It does. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Now, don't go, oh, no, that's not romantic love. It goes off in a different category. No, it doesn't. It sits on the same foundation. John is crystal clear. He does not mince words. Love equals Jesus on the cross. Love equals Jesus on the cross. There it is. black and white, crystal clear. Self-sacrifice for the good of the other. And the Bible says, this is love. I'll quote John Mark Comer again. I didn't give this to the folks on the slide, so it's my fault. But he said this, if you want to know what love looks like, don't look at a dictionary. Look at a Jewish prophet crucified outside Jerusalem. Look at God in the flesh giving his life away for the world. That's it. And then here's the next verse, verse 11. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. That's what love is, and that's what you're supposed to do. That's love. Now go do it. The sacrifice of self for the well-being and the good of the other. Love. There it is. It's right there in the text as well. You see it in verse 10. We see love as a noun and love as a verb. It's an action. And take note, love, this is important, love is commanded of us. Commanded. Now, if the Bible is talking primarily about desire or emotion or attraction or affection or a fluttering heart, that can't be commanded. You can't command that. You can't command feelings. And yet we are commanded to love. As we're going to talk about more next week, and we will, romance and affection and desire and fluttering hearts, these things all really, really matter, and they're really, really important. In marriage, and hear me, they can be nurtured and they could be tended to. It's like a garden. If it's tended to carefully, it can flourish and thrive. And as cold and unromantic as I have been today, I readily acknowledge there's something magic about romance. I don't know what else to call it. There's just something magic. And we can't always generate it, but we can sustain it. But that's romance. Love, however, at its core, the core that is shared by all the different kinds of love, is a command with a choice to either obey or disobey. A command to selflessness, a command to sacrifice, service. It is unconditional, it is non-contingent. Sometimes it is reciprocated, sometimes it is not, but the command remains. And it's a command to put others ahead of yourself. And it applies to romance and to marriage just as it applies to every other kind of love. Love equals Jesus on the cross. And your first and greatest commandment in marriage, as in with all other aspects of your life, is to be like Jesus. And so John says, dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Okay. I think I'm out of rants. A person is going to come and play music to help shut things down here. David, you are not Aaron, clearly. Welcome, David. And just in case, again, I want to push back because I think we do have this tendency to go, well, okay, you're talking about love in the broadest sense, but I'm talking about romance in particular. Okay, let's talk about romance in particular. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, Paul writes, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. What's he saying? This whole love equals Jesus on the cross? Oh, it applies to how you go live your life in the broadest sense, and it applies specifically to your spouse. And that's the core, and that's the foundation. You might still be reeling a little bit, and you go, but what about the fluttering heart, and what about those things? Don't they matter? And somebody might say, well, how was church this morning? And you'd say, Pastor Aaron murdered romance. It's over now. This is the day the music died. You might go home and say that. Please don't. If you're saying, what about the fluttering heart? Listen, we all know about the fluttering heart and the electricity, and it's great. And we all know that it's short-lived. It comes and goes, but here's the deal. If you build your marriage on this foundation, the love equals Jesus on the cross foundation, here's the insider tip that we'll get to next week. You get to keep the fluttering heart. You do. Not every hour of every day, okay? Let's not be ridiculous. There'll be seasons when you can't, where did the fluttering heart, I don't know. But as a baseline, You get to keep the fluttering heart. That was designed by God too. It's part of the magic of romance and how God designed male and female to interact with one another. It's part of the deal. Just listen, you live in a world when you are drowned, you are just constantly flooded with the idea that the sacrificial love is secondary and the fluttering heart is primary. And I want every person in this room to choose to acknowledge that's a lie. The foundation is what Jesus did on the cross. Self-sacrifice. The foundation is unconditional love extended to the people in our lives. Out of that foundation, you can get and then even sustain all that magical romantic stuff. Okay, let's take a moment now for Selah to be still and to pray. We'll make this brief and we'll shortly go into communion because communion is a continuation of what we're doing now. So Holy Spirit, please come and speak to us in the stillness. And it really is quite simple, Lord. If we have fallen for the lie, would you just show us that? If we just fall, if we've gotten duped to some degree or another, that it could even be a rational statement to say, I love you, I'm just not in love with you anymore. If we've fallen for it to any degree, would you expose it to us now? Show it to us. Help us to see what the foundation is. And we, with anticipation, await what, when that's lived out in romance, the electricity and the icing on the cake, we know it's all still there. Look forward to it, but God, help us to stand on the right foundation and to not, for some reason, put romantic love in this wholly different category, making it weak and vulnerable when you have made it foundational. So speak to us, Lord.